Blog Talk Radio.
Thursday night, August 19th, 2010, at 8 o'clock, and the Hermetic Hour. We're having call-in night tonight, and as a main topic between calls, we'll discuss the magical attributes and detriments of the naughtiest man in the world, Aleister Crowley. And of course, this topic is just specifically chosen to get you to call in. We do expect a spirited response, especially from Thelemites. Now, I will read selections from Crowley's poetry and will review the recent Crowley movie, also the Somerset Maugham novel and the silent film The Magician, and we'll discuss the Book of the Law in relation to the Enochian Key of the 30 Aethers. That ought to be interesting, and offer some droll Crowley antidotes? Anecdotes. No, we don't have any antidotes for droll Crowley. And if you don't like Crowley, well, we'll defend him, and if you do like him, we'll attack him. And all of which, of course, he would enjoy immensely. And so will we. So let's get on with it. 93, skidoo. And the best way to get this started and rolling is to read one of Crowley's poems, which I personally happen to like. This is my personal favorite, and I like to read this once a year at Bardic Circle. So here is The Wizard's Way. Velvet soft, the night star glowed over the untrodden road, through the giant glades of yew, where its ray fell light as dew, lighting up the shimmering veil, maiden pure and airy frail, that the spiders wove to hide, brushes of the sylvan bride, earth that trembled with delight at the male caress of night. Velvet soft the wizard trod to the sabbath of his god. With his naked feet he made starry blossoms in the glade, softly, softly as he went to the somber sacrament, stealthy stepping to the tryst in his gown of amethyst. Earlier yet his soul had come to the hill of martyrdom, where the charred and crooked stake, like a black and venomed snake, by the hangman's hands is thrust through the wet and writhing dust. Never black and never dried, heart's blood of a suicide. He had plucked the hazel rod from the rude and goatish god, even as the curved moon's waning ray stolen from the king of day. He had learnt the elvish sign, given the token of the nine, once to rave and once to revel, once to bow before the devil, once to swing the thurible, once to kiss the goat of hell, once to dance the aspen spring, once to croak and once to sing, once to oil the savory thighs of the witch with sea-green eyes, with the unguent's magic howl of the honey and the gall, and of the black enchanter's lips as he croons to the eclipse, mingling that most puissant spell of the giant gods of hell, with the four ingredients of the evil elements, ambergris from golden jar, musk of ox from mongrel jar, civet from a box of jade, mixed with a maid, slain by the enchantments cold of the witches wild and old. He had crucified a toad in the basilisk abode, muttering the runes of verse, mad with many a mocking curse. He had traced a serpent sigil in his ghastly virgin vigil. Searsome Cor, the elfin hill, where the wind blows deadly chill from the world that roars beneath death's black throat and lipless teeth. And there he stood, his bosom bare, tracing life upon the air, with the crook and with the flail, lashing forward on the gale, till its blade that wavereth like the flickering of death sank before his subtle fence to the starless sea of sense. Now at last the man has come, haply to his halidom, surely as he waves his rod in a circle on the sod, springs the emerald chaste and clean from the duller, paler green. Surely in the circle millions of immaculate pavilions flash upon the trembling turf, like the sea stars in the surf, millions of bejeweled tents for the warrior sacraments. Vaster, 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 vaster grows the stature of the master. All the ringed encampment lies with the infinite galaxies, and in the midst a cubic stone with the devils at their own, with a limb of the lamb's virginal throat, half the body of a stoat, half the buttocks of a goat, half the sanguine face and rod of a goddess and a god. Spell by spell and pace by pace, mystic flashes swing and trace, velvet soft the sigil stepped, by the silver star adept, back and forth and to and fro, soul and body sway and flow, in vertiginous caresses of twin ponderable recesses, till at last the spell is woven, and the fairy veil is cloven. That was sequence, space, and stress of the soul-sick consciousness. Give thy body to the beast, give thy spirit to the priest, break in twain the hazel rod on the virgin lips of God, tear the rosy cross asunder, shatter the black bolt of thunder, stuck the swart and sanguine kiss of the resolute abyss. Wonder weft the wizard heard this intolerable word, smote the blasting hazel rod on the scarlet lips of God, trampled cross and rosy core, break the thunder tool of Thor, meek and holy acolyte of the priestly hells of spite, sleek and shameless catamite of the beasts that prowl by night, like a star that streams from heaven through the virgin air's light riven. From the lift there shot and fell an admirable miracle, carved minute and clean a key of purest lapis lazuli, more blue than the blind sky that arches, wreathed with the stars, her torturing snakes, from the dead god's kiss that never wakes, shot with golden specks of fire, like a virgin with desire. Look, the levers, fern frail fronds of fantastic diamonds, glimmering with the ethereal azure in each exquisite embrasure. On the shaft the letters laced, as if dryads, lunar chaste, with the satyrs were embraced, spelled the secret of the key, sick Prevenius, and he went his wizard way in weaving dreams of things beyond believing. And of course, that's not all of it. It goes on and on and on. How is it possible? How is it possible, if we are romantics, and of course, I believe that all magicians really should be romantics, if they're not, how can we as romantics not just love and admire this genius, this marvelous magician? This, oh, I mean, this is good stuff. Now, however, there's a good side to Crowley, and there's a great side to Crowley, there's a not so good side to Crowley. So we're going to get into this is Frankly, to tell you the truth, I'm not a Thelemite. I thought I was way back when I first got started in this business, and that was back in 1969, 1970. I thought I was a Thelemite, as I got into magic and realized that it really did have power and it really did have a reality of its own, I began to sort of question whether or not it'd be a good idea to be a Thelemite. And by 1971, I had decided I wasn't a Thelemite. However, that does not change the fact, as far as I'm concerned, Crowley is one of the major figures in the rebirth and in the creation of the modern magical art. And in many ways, I know that this is a controversial point of view, but I think Crowley is really, in a way, responsible for our modern magical approach. The reason why I say that is this. Crowley made an accommodation in his magic. He made an accommodation with the Darwinians and the whole Rousseau, Helvetius, Illuminati, Marxist, Skinnerite, Freudian, modern, God is dead if there ever was one kind of point of view that the modern world or the humanists seem to want to have. The wrong turn that we made during the so-called Enlightenment, Crowley made an accommodation with that, and so he brought magic into the modern world. Magic, with Crowley, was a form of psychology. And Crowley wasn't a Jungian, of course. He was more Freudian than Jungian. And so he modernized magic. He made it into his religion that he created was a synthetic, because Babylon, of course, is out of the Book of Revelations, and there owes something, I suppose, to Simon Magus's Helen, but mainly taken out of the Book of Revelations as a counterfoil, sort of like a Satan character. She's Babylon's sort of a counter religious figure, and critics have pointed out that Crowley, growing up in a fundamentalist home where his mother wouldn't and his father wouldn't let him read anything but the Bible and Pilgrim's Progress until he got to be almost ready for college. So Babylon was, quite frankly, in the Book of Revelations, was just masturbation fantasy, and so he made her into his goddess. Well, this is a synthetic. This is the synthetics that the Greco-Egyptians came up with. Serapis was a synthetic that they came up with. And so having a synthetic goddess or having a synthetic mythology that he created, Crowley could bring magic up into the modern era where the sort of godless, anti-religious kind of era and really give it some validity as a modern system. Actually, otherwise, magic would stay as an anachronism, as the old fuddy-duddies that still believe the world is flat and they're out there with their robes and their wands summoning spirits and all that. Nobody would have take them seriously, and so Crowley accomplished what he did by this modernizing of magic. He enabled magic to come into the 20th century. Now, of course, you can say that, well, Barden was a better magician and Barden was doing his thing and all that, and that's great. But Barden was very, very low profile compared to Crowley. Crowley was very prominent and made sure that he was. That's why, he liked this title, The Wickedest Man in the World. Actually, he wasn't. He was, as I said, the naughtiest man in the world. And that's because he liked to shock people. And once you understand that, you can forgive him some of his pranks, because he was doing them basically to break the stodgy Victorian mold. And one of the reasons, of course, why Crowley's particular rebelliousness is it's no longer necessary because we've had our sexual revolution and we don't need that all that rebellion at this time. But at that time, yeah, and I kind of think they did. And so I am really going to give Crowley the credit. Now, I'll tell you something else, too. Crowley really was a romantic, even though he did accommodate the Freudians and the rest of the so-called moderns. Even though he did make accommodation with them, he was still very much a romantic. And that poem that I read at the beginning, that's from volume one of the Equinox, number one. That poem that I read at the beginning of the show, that should definitely prove, beyond any doubt, that Crowley was certainly a romantic. Now, the question here is, yes, he was a romantic, but was he really one of these people that believed that there was no spiritual nature in man? Was he just promoting the bestial qualities of man? Well, there's a problem there. How much spirituality does Crowley actually believe in, or is he promoting the bestiality of a man in the truest sense? In other words, the beast quality where you don't have the special soul that makes you human. Where is Crowley in that? Well, we're not quite sure, because on the one hand, he's a romantic, and then he has a spiritual dimension, and on the other hand, he is extolling the animal side of man and the idea of the conquering child. Crowley, something that I think we should realize is that Crowley was, number one, a genius, and he was not just a genius, he was a protean genius. This man could play chess with four people simultaneously and win all four games. He won his chess blue at Cambridge. He was a chess master, and of course he was a very talented mountain climber, although the mountain climbing community didn't like him very much because he left a few people up there on the mountain when he came down. But I think we have a call. You're on the air, Sir Medigar.
Hey, this is Keith in Tucson, Arizona.
Yeah, Keith. What do you want to ask us? Go ahead and tell us what you think.
Well, I'm not a big fan of Crowley. I always thought he was a kind of a big contradiction and kind of did a disservice to ceremonial magic and the credibility of it, because for a man that was supposedly had so much power and was such a pioneer, the way his life ended, you know, kind of just seemed to discredit a lot of what he stood for, I think, in my opinion. It's just one of those things that someone on the outside looking in would point to the way his life ended, that he ended broke, miserable, and a drug addict, that, if he was so powerful and was able to command magic, then why did his life end the way it ended?
I'm going to agree with everything you're saying. And yet I'm going to defend Crowley a little bit, because we said, you know, in the abstract when we got started, we said, well, if you don't like him, we're going to defend him, and if you do like him, we're going to attack him, both of which he would enjoy. Now, but what you're saying, see, there's a part of me that agrees with everything you're saying. Everything.
Right.
I do. And as I said, I'm not a Thelemite. I gave it up. I gave it up very, very quickly on. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. But here, the thing about Crowley's drug addiction let's cut him a little slack on that, because when he was a child, he had asthma, and he had very bad asthma, and they prescribed heroin for him in an inhaler. You know, he inhaled it with a little ball in it, you know, and he stuck it up his nose. And so he was, by the time he, 1947, when he was 74 years old and living in a, yeah, you're right, he was living in a cold water flat, and depending upon his, you know, his followers, weren't very many of them, to send him money to keep him going. But by that time, he was ingesting enough heroin to kill an elephant. But it started off, you know, it was a prescription drug, and that's what he was doing. So that part of it, well, I won't say I'm going to forgive him for it. I think he could have mastered it. He even wrote a novel one time, you know, where he pictured himself as being able to cure other people of drug addiction. I don't know whether he read that novel or not. It's just interesting, but no, he was saddled with that, and it was multiple substance addiction. It wasn't just heroin; it was just about everything. And so that was a big flaw, and one of the problems, of course, with Crowley is because of that multiple substance addiction that he had, and that means that we have people today who follow Crowley. They don't follow him because of his magic, and they don't follow him necessarily because of his philosophy or anything like that. They follow him because this was a guy that took all these drugs and, you know, and still was telling people what to do, and he was a cult leader. But mainly because he did all this stuff. And that's wrong. I mean, that's not the reason to follow Crowley. If you you want a reason to follow Crowley, well, then his philosophy and all of that, if that's what you want to follow him for in his work and his system, then fine. But don't use it as an excuse for your drug addiction. And that's unfortunately is what's happened with a number of thelemites. And so I agree with you there. Now, as far as his magic is concerned, I know somebody else also mentioned that, oh, he was a lousy magician. Well, yeah, he kind of was, because he had a high, squeaky voice, and he lisped, and so he really wasn't very good at hypnotic type magic, and not very successful with in ritual work. But that wasn't really what he was trying to do with magic. Crowley believed he was the reincarnation of Eliphas Levi, and so he, and Levi said, the power of the magician, Levi was a lousy magician too, by the way, and Levi said, the power of the magician is in creating his religion. So this is what Crowley was trying to do. Everything Crowley was trying to do was going toward creating this synthetic religion of his. And in that respect, well, he's had a lot more success after he died than he ever had while he was alive. Does this answer your question pretty much, do you think?
Yeah, I did. It was mine was just more of a, you know, an observation of how I just never was able to really take anything he wrote really serious, or not, and probably half of the stuff that he wrote probably wasn't even really trying to be serious, because he was a big I mean, he did have a good sense of humor in a lot of stuff that he wrote, so it's just that, you know, people that look at him as like he's just great person.
He had a great sense of humor, and he had a lot of he loved to play tricks on people.
Right.
I mean, in fact, Zanry and I were talking before. She said, "Folks, you got to tell a story about Dion Fortune and the mackerel." Yeah, you know, this is what talking about Crowley anecdotes. Crowley and Gerald York, and I can't prove this one, but this is. Was swore up down it was true, that Gerald York and Crowley together, when Dion Fortune was 18 years of age, she looked up to the both, and they both told her that she needed to invoke Mercury, a mercurial spirit. And what she was supposed to do was go into the privacy of her bedchamber and strip herself starkers and rub herself all over with a mackerel. So she went and did this, and then she came back and told them about her experience, and the two of them started laughing, and they almost fell off their chairs laughing at her, and she never spoke to either of them again. This is the sort of stuff Curly did. I mean, he was outrageous. He was a merry prankster, and some of his pranks were kind of vicious, I know. But, you know, aside from those two guys that he left up on the mountain, he never killed anybody. By the way, have you seen that Crowley movie yet?
No, I haven't, actually. I've heard about it, but no, I haven't seen it.
It's a lot of fun. I'm going to talk about that a little later. That movie's a lot of fun. Crowley, of course, because it's supposedly a horror film, he does horrible things, but he does them in a very funny way. Anyway, I let's get on to some other callers. If you got...
Okay, great.
Thanks for calling in. Right, bye. Okay, look, there's one thing that I want to point out here. Crowley knew, and this is for all of his joking around and all of his going off on the wrong tax and stuff like that, stuff that we really kind of looking back on today when we're past the need for all this rebellion and everything like this. We're looking back on Crowley, and it's easy to criticize, but let's don't ever make the mistake of not thinking that Crowley knew what it was all about, because he did. And I want to read you something from the Book of Wisdom and Folly. It's a very short one here, and I want you to listen closely, because it's in Crowley's pseudo-biblical prose, and it very much needs a translation into plain, simple English. But listen to this, and then you'll realize that Crowley knows what it's all about. This is called the De Formula Summa. It's on page 28 of Wisdom and Folly. Learn, moreover, that thyself includeth the whole universe of thy knowledge, so that every increase upon every plane is an aggrandizement of that self. Yet the greater part of this universe is common knowledge, so that thyself is interwoven with other selves, save for that part peculiar to thyself. And as thou growest, so also this peculiar part is ever of less proportion to the whole, until when thou becomest infinite, it is a quality infinitesimal and to be neglected. Lo, when the all is absorbed within the I, it is as if the I were absorbed within the all. For if two things become wholly and indissolubly one thing, then there is no reason for names, since names are given to mark off one thing from another. And this is that which is written in the book of the law. Quote, let there be no difference made among you between any one thing and any other thing, for thereby there cometh hurt. But whoso availeth in this, let him be the chief of all. Now, I know that's a little bit obscure, but it proves to me, at least, that Crowley did know what it was all about. He really did. And it is sometimes it's saddening to think, even though he knew what it was all about, somehow or other, that was not the important thing he was trying to lead people to. And therein, I think, is his largest failing, is that he didn't lead his students to that truth. And one of the problems is that he was so fascinated and so fixated on rebellion that he continued to, all his life, he continued to engender this rebellious philosophy. Well, rebellion is fine. Everybody, especially magicians, everybody's got to rebel. I mean, everybody, every teenager that ever lived has to go through a rebellious period. You got to. It's part of the process. And especially magicians who really, really need to express themselves, and they really need to find their own creativity, and they have to. So they've got to rebel. But once you have successfully rebelled, then your job is to go on and seek enlightenment. Find that's when you go for this marvelous equilibrium and this enlightenment. And if you just keep rebelling, you're just going through a spiritual revolving door. And that's one of the problems with Crowley's system, I think, personally, is that it does. These people are there, they're rebelling, and it keeps on and keeps on and keeps on. And so that keeps them from the clear light. But, however, regardless of that, we know from this passage in Wisdom of Folly that Crowley did know. He knew. Now, one of the things that I said I was going to do when we were discussing this, I said I was going to talk about this film Crowley, and it came out just a few years ago. You can get it on DVD and you get it on Amazon. I'm not trying to plug it. I mean, really, we didn't do it. I wish we had. It's a beautiful film, but it's a horror. It's kind of a horror film. It's a science fiction type film, and the idea is Crowley reincarnates through a computer, and this modern college, their university, they're doing total immersion, virtual reality, total immersion experiments with this big mainframe computer, and one of the professors, who is named Oliver Haddo, and of course that's an inside joke. By the way, the guys that wrote this screenplay, they really know Crowley. I mean, they got every inside joke in there you can think of, and so Oliver Haddo is this college professor who is kind of looks like Crowley, but he has a speech impediment, but he stutters and all, and he goes into the virtual reality suit, and they plug him in, and sure enough, Crowley gets him through the computer and takes him over, and he then becomes Crowley, and then he goes out to find the Scarlet Woman and all the rest. Now this is a lot of fun, but he does, of course, Crowley does, in this film, he does horrible things. He does really, but all the horrible things he does are things that Crowley would have probably liked you to think he would do anyway. It's just outrageous, but it's beautifully done. Now, so I heartily recommend that film, Crowley. Now, talking about an earlier film, Dan Oliver Haddo. Crowley's sometimes friend, W. Somerset Maugham, the great British novelist, wrote a novel, and this is something that isn't generally known because Maugham's estate for a long, long time didn't even want to admit that this novel existed, and Maugham finally, before he died, he realized that for what it was, the novel was pretty good, so he allowed him to reissue it. It's called The Magician. And you can get it right now in some reprints. It's a fairly short little novel. But Maugham, at the time he wrote this, this was back in the 1920s, the time he wrote this, he went into the British Museum and really, really researched magic, did an amazing amount of research on the novel, and he based his villain in the novel on Crowley and called him Oliver Haddo. He created the name Oliver Haddo, which Crowley thereafter used as a pseudonym for articles of the Equinox, and of course it shows up again in this movie, Crowley. But Oliver Haddo is a magician and a hypnotist in the novel, and he seduces this young woman, and he needs her virgin's blood to create a homunculus, and this actually the Frankenstein film owes something to this, A German producer by the name Rex Ingram, back in 1926, Rex Ingram did a silent movie production of The Magician, and this is a marvelous film. I mean, it's just recently they had it on one of the cable channels, and they had a beautiful print of it. I know I had a terrible fourth generation print of it. That I loaned to the fellow of mine up in San Francisco, and I had to fight him to get it back, and that was a lousy, lousy print. But this, now they got this new, beautiful, pristine print of The Magician, and so if you can get it, if you can somehow get that, you'll want to really have a look at it. That's the original Oliver Haddo. And Crowley, as I said, then Crowley used Oliver Haddo as a pseudonym for some of his articles in the Equinox. Crowley was a remarkable, I won't say magician. Let's say he was a remarkable writer and tremendously talented in a number of areas. But the problem that I have with him, and with his philosophy, by the way, is that the third chapter of his Book of the Law is frankly so ruthless and so unsympathetic to other human beings that I just simply can't commit to it. I find that I can't. In fact, Crowley himself, after he and his wife channeled it back in 1904, they channeled it in Cairo, Egypt, after looking at this stela in the museum at Cairo, Egypt, and then they went back up into their hotel room and smoked enough hashish to get them into a state of, you know, whatever, and then between the two of them, they channeled this Book of the Law, which Liberaldo Legis. It's in three chapters. It's a fairly short little book. And this is an expression of this Egyptian spirit, whom Crowley calls Iwas, in which he is declaring a new aeon. And what he's declaring is the death is the final end of the aeon of Isis and Osiris, which, of course, as I'm sure you people that are into this, you realize that Isis and Osiris are very close to Christianity in its sense of the Redeemer, the Judgment, and the afterlife, and judgment, and all of that. But what this Book of the Law does is Iwas comes in and declares that this is now the Aeon of Horus, and that there isn't any last judgment. Do whatever you want. There is no karma. There is no last judgment. The strong will rule and trample the weak underfoot and take over. And this is the new aeon of the crown and conquering child. Now, the Book of the Law has some beautiful imagery in it. Similar to what I was reading in The Wizard's Way. It's beautiful. It has some beautiful passages in it. It has some, you could say that it's a supernatural work. I would concede that it's a supernatural work. And yet, at the same time, I want to point out that if you read, put the Book of the Law on one side of your table, and put the call of the 30 Aethers, the Enochian call of the 30 Aethers, on the left side of your table, and you start reading the two, go back and forth and start reading the two, the call of the 30 Aethers and the Book of the Law, you're going to find a lot of similarities. The call of the 30 Aethers is an apocalyptic, it's the utterances of a vicious, the vicious God who claims that he's sorry he even made human beings in the first place, and he's telling them to weed each other out and kill each other off and do whatever, you know, the strong will destroy the weak and whatever. You see this in the Call of the 30 Aethers, which is one of the reasons why when we do Enochian in the OTA, we're very, very careful with it, and we do it just... We do the Aethers, we explore the Aethers just for knowledge. That's all. We don't work the system to try to align ourselves with any of these this sort of thing. But the Book of the Law, the third chapter especially, as a lot of this philosophy. Now, personally, if we have to ask ourselves, well, do you want to commit yourself to this sort of thing, and is that going to be your path? And I would say this. I would say that if you are the kind of person who doesn't really feel any guilt about being ruthless and being selfish and being and trampling anyone and getting your way under your feet, if you don't feel guilty about that, if you're that kind of person, then I think the book of the law is probably what you want to follow. And, you know, it's good. That is good for you. And then it might very well get you beyond any karma because, you know, if you don't feel any guilt, karma is guilt-driven. If you don't feel any guilt, but what I also think, though, is that even if you were beaten with a Jesus stick or beaten with a Moses stick when you were a kid, and you had your creativity squashed and you had your sexuality repressed and all these kind of things in the name of religion, and so you want to make a rebellion, and you look at the book of the law and you're thinking, oh boy, yeah, this is what, but just watch out, because if you've got Jesus or you got Moses sitting back there somewhere up there in your head, if you got one of them sitting up there, and he's whispering in your inner ear, then maybe you better not, because you are, if you feel guilty, then that means you're still there. And so I would say then leave it alone. And don't, for heaven's sake, just because Crowley did a lot of drugs and did a lot of kinky sex, that's not a reason to follow this philosophy. Because even if you do drugs and even if you do kinky sex, this does not necessarily mean that you want to squash other people and you want to be entirely selfish. It doesn't mean that. But it's attractive, of course, because, you know, it makes an excuse for it. That's my problem with Thelema. I don't have any, that's why I'm not Thelemite, but then on the other hand, let's look at it this way. There's a lot of people that you know, do resonate with this, and supposedly maybe that's what they ought to do. And one of the things, of course, about Crowley that he appeals so much to that part of us that is that way. I mean, you know, I have a dark side. We all do, or a side that wants to get up and fight for what I think is mine and whatever. We all have that, and that's appealing. And a magician, especially a magician, feels that he or she is something special. Magician, we do. I mean, we feel like special people. We know things that other people don't know. We have powers that other people don't have, and so this has a lot of appeal. And Crowley's magic does have, and his philosophy does have that appeal. And oh boy, and he's such a, as far as I'm concerned, such a fun writer to read. I mean, I really enjoy Crowley's work. I enjoy his fiction. I enjoy his poetry. In fact, I tell you the truth, I think he's a better poet than William Butler Yeats. I know that very, 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 very astute intellectuals will say that, oh, well, Crowley's poetry is just old balladeering, you know. But doggone it, I like old balladeering. I love it. I like Crowley's poetry. And on that book of that tarot deck of his that Freda Harris did, that book of Thoth, that's magnificently beautiful. Now, one of the reasons we got another call. Now, one of the reasons why that tarot deck is so beautiful, and this may surprise you. By the way, the guest call in number, and Zandri just reminded me, is 347 857 1-800-273-1830 if you want to call in. We got another 15 minutes. One of the reasons why that Thoth tarot deck is so beautiful. Pat Celesti sat one night when he was visiting me. We were up till about 3 o'clock in the morning going over the color scheme of the Golden Dawn's Minuta Mundum. And Pat said, he said, mate, there's nobody's ever done a Golden Dawn tarot deck right, because the colors in each one of the cards have got to be derived from the color of the sphere and the color of the path. And nobody's ever done this. And Lang didn't do it, and the Ciceros didn't do it. Nobody's done it yet. But Crowley knew this, and he did it in with Freda Harris in the Thoth deck. And that's one of the reasons why that thing has so much magical power, is the colors are right. Now, that brings us to perhaps our last topic here that we'll get into. It's just, where is Crowley and his magic in relation to the Golden Dawn? And so I'm going to, and in order to get that kind of straightened out, I'm going to read a little section about that from a paper that I delivered at a Masonic Symposium up in San Francisco a few years back. And when I was trying to explain this to California Masons, because they couldn't tell what the difference of the OTO and the Golden Dawn was at that time, and they were lumping us all into kind of the same bag. So I said, I'll get in the middle of this paper here because I don't want to read the whole thing. Which brings us to the last of our major complaints concerning the Golden Dawn, its alleged connection with the libertine Gnostic philosophy and practices of Aleister Crowley's Thelemic sect. Now, how can an order that claims to be Rosicrucian also be connected with an iconoclastic and apparently anti-Judeo-Christian faction following the tenets of Crowley's Liberale Vel Legis, the Book of the Law? Well, the answer is, it cannot and it does not. The Golden Dawn is not Thelemic, and even if an attempt to create a Thelemic Golden Dawn were to be successful, it would still be a philosophical oxymoron. It is not my purpose here to denigrate Crowley, his philosophy, or his followers. They get all the criticism they need from my esteemed colleagues. In Crowley's defense, I will say that he was really not the wickedest man in the world, however much he enjoyed that label in the tabloid press, but he might have actually aspired to the title of the world's naughtiest man. I have a footnote on that, and I'll read in a minute. But be that as it may, there are three reasons why Aleister Crowley has been linked to the Golden Dawn and why some people believe the Golden Dawn is linked with Crowley. First, Crowley joined the Golden Dawn in 1898, the age of 23, and he went through all the order outer grades, but he was refused entrance to the inner order, the RRAC, in London. He was subsequently initiated as an Adeptus Minor by McGregor Mathers in Paris in 1900. So he was certainly a member. But then we must recall that neither Adolf Hitler or Al Capone were ever excommunicated from the Catholic Church, whereas Crowley was certainly declared persona non grata in the Golden Dawn, not only by Yeats in London, but later by his own mentor, Mathers, in Paris. About Crowley's association with the Golden Dawn, Ellick Howe himself states that, quote, his prominence was brief and his influence minimal. Now, secondly, Crowley appropriated and published Golden Dawn papers in his periodical, The Equinox, and subsequently used GD materials in his own order of the Argentum Astrum, that's the AA. This is true, but McGregor Mathers took him to court on this issue. Crowley also revised GD rituals that he had lifted to conform with the tenets of his 1904 Revelatory Book of the Law. Third, that the psychedelic and sexual liberation era of the middle 1960s and early 1970s brought about a revival of Crowley's works and a spate of books about him. Now, this popular focus on Crowley was the more sensational aspects of his philosophy, in effect the use of drugs and sex, and it tended to connect his early Golden Dawn period with his later, more controversial views and activities. Now, making this brief GD connections seem even more important. Crowley's former secretary, Israel Rigardi, who was himself a former Golden Dawn member, and had published the largest collection of GD material up to that time, he became the leading author promoting the Crowley revival in the 1970s. And even though the philosophies, methods, rituals, and aspirations of Crowley's Ordo Templi Orientis and the original Golden Dawn are significantly different in almost every respect, Rigardi tended to blur these disparities in an intellectual smorgasbord of exotic offerings in print. If the truth be known, to use one of Rigardi's favorite expressions, Crowley's Aeon of Horus, the new era of the crowned and conquering child, is a specific and obvious rebellion against the Golden Dawn's Osirian, Rosicrucian, and biblical ethos. Therefore, to make the Golden Dawn polemic, you would have to literally turn its philosophy upside down. There is no appeal to sexual liberation, social radicalism, or ecstatic shamanism in any Golden Dawn ritual. In fact, the exact opposite is true. However justifiable the polemic spiritual rebellion against repressive Victorian age biblical morality may or may not have been, the Golden Dawn was certainly not a party to it. In actual fact, the Golden Dawn was one of the primary targets of Crowley's polemic rebellion. Now, I think that that pretty much solves that problem that some people have had in figuring out just where the Golden Dawn is at in relation to Crowley. And, you know, Crowley learned a lot from the Golden Dawn, but the Golden Dawn didn't learn anything from Crowley at all, except to fight among themselves, which got so bad during the recent internet era of the news groups. This got so bad that frankly, right now, any organization that openly calls itself the Golden Dawn, I would kind of stay away from, because Crowley at least taught them how to squabble and how to fight and whatever. But in many, many ways, to get back to the good side of Crowley, in many, many ways, he really, really did bring magic up into the 20th century and even the 21st century. And right now, I'm sure you're all aware that we have a kind of a reactionary movement going on in magic. We have some very, very good practitioners and even some good scholars of magic who are trying to get back to this completely superstitious pre-Darwinian, pre-Freudian, pre-Enlightenment, actually pre-Enlightenment era when magic was at least by the intermediate practitioners, anyway, it was completely a superstitious thing, and they're trying to kind of do this, whereas the mainstream of the new magical movement is that it's like Flan says, it's all in your head, but you have no idea how big your head is. And hypnosis is what makes it go. And we're all linked up with Jungian psychology, and we don't require miracles that are photographable or anything like that. We're more in touch in many, many ways now. We are more in touch today, right now, with the high end of Hermetic philosophy in the Renaissance. Because Hermetic philosophy in the Renaissance, Agrippa and the rest of these magicians in the Renaissance, they really knew that magic was in your mind. They really knew that what you were seeing in the crystal and in the mirror and whatever was something that you were seeing through the filter of your subjective mind. They knew that. And that's the high end of Hermetic philosophy, as we've tried to say here. Everything is is the mind of God, and you are in touch with the mind of God, and you are the eyes and ears of the mind of God. And therefore, what you see in that crystal, what you see in that mirror, what you hear in the voice in your head, that's real. But you don't have to photograph it, and you don't have to find it living in some cave out in the woods for it to be real. And Crowley helped us very, very much get to that point. He helped us. If it hadn't been for Crowley, gosh, you know, we might still be, magic might still be a philosophy that sane, intelligent, intellectual people would laugh at. But now they are, you know, they begin taking us a little more seriously, and as well they should. Western magic is just as valid as Tibetan Tantra. It's just as valid, just as good, just as powerful, just as beautiful, just as highly developed, if we take that Renaissance Hermetic approach, which frankly, during the Faustian period and during the reaction against the Enlightenment, got into a very superstitious thing. We never had any pacts with the devil until the 1700s. There weren't any, you know, magicians controlled evil spirits, and they got them to work for them, but they didn't have any pacts with them, not until the superstitious aspect of it started in, and after the 1700s. So Crowley, in many, many ways, has really, really helped us in getting ahead, although I think, which you know, that we've pointed out where the break was with the Golden Dawn, what the difference is, and what you really ought to consider if you're going to follow the book of the law, then you really ought to look inside yourself and see just how, you know, see just what your attitude is toward other human beings, and ask yourself that question. And now I think we've got that pretty well nailed down. And next week we're going to get into another, well, kind of a controversial area. We're going to talk about Kenneth Grant and Austin Spare and Kenneth Grant. And Kenneth Grant, as you probably know, or most of you do, is kind of an OTO. It's a creative spinoff from Crowley. And Kenneth Grant is, in his own way, he is, and he's very romantic, and in his own way, he is a marvelous romantic genius on the dark side. And so we will discuss Kenneth Grant's works and his philosophy, and also one of his mentors, Austin Spare, who is the Austin Spare is kind of the great original avatar of chaos magic, and I'm not really up on chaos magic that much, so we'll confine our discussions to Kenneth Grant and Austin Spare and hold on to chaos magic until later when we get somebody in here who knows more about it than I do. Empedocles said that everything is air, fire, and water, love and strife. Okay, I'll see you next week, and we'll do Kenneth Grant. Bye-bye.